the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Veronica Dagger of the Wall Street Journal and Reasons for Parents to Reveal Estate Plans. You know, there was a time when life was easy. Nah. Well, at least it seemed easier than it is now. Maybe the years you spent lazing by the pool in high school or something like that. I mean, you worked hard and at the end of your career, you headed off into the sunset. The music was playing with secure retirement. The guaranteed income was pretty secure. You can do that if you want. Yeah, movie soundtrack there. Add that in. Maybe some waves sloshing on the beach or something like that. You know, the company you work for gave you a pension and, as Bob Newhart said, and a crummy watch. The combination of Social Security and a company pension, you knew that based on just those two, you were going to get along and life was going to provide you through your retirement years. Life was simpler back then and you simply knew where you stood. Today, well, unfortunately, it is a different world. Gone is the watch. I don't know why. I mean, you can get a decent watch for a cheap price. But anyway, you don't get the watch anymore and the guaranteed pension.
And it certainly isn't gold if you got one.
I wasn't thinking so.
Not at $1,200.
Yeah, you probably want to pawn the watch and put it into your retirement plan. So anyway, Social Security is still there for now, but the retirement dates are moving backwards, and they most definitely, even the COLAs, the cost of living adjustments, don't keep up with inflation. We know that that just doesn't happen. What you saved is all you seem to have. This makes it even tougher because the Fed has driven interest rates down to zero. So now even those savings don't really buy you very much. And that means you have to be a little more adventurous into putting your money in places where it can earn money and a little more cautious about where you do place it. What we're going to do today is talk about the new retirement paradigm, how today's retirees face a different retirement than their parents. And surprisingly, though, it may be a different environment, but it doesn't have to be that bad.
Here's the thing that we're starting to see, and of course, people have heard this statistic before, but every day over the next decade, 10,000 boomers will head into retirement. And as you mentioned, John, it'll be much different. Social Security is still there, but you'll have to wait longer to get full benefits. The guaranteed pensions are pretty much gone, and the return on safe investments, as we have talked about, especially on the weekends, have been drastically diminished. I mean, what you used to be able to get at the bank on a CD or a T-bill, you know, those returns aren't there anymore. So it's a much different environment, but it's also one that's filled with opportunities. Bankers Life has just published a major survey report on retirement. It's called New Expectations, New Rewards, Work in Retirement for Middle Income Boomers. Now, you won't be surprised as a listener to this program. For most middle income boomers, it really involves some form of work.
You know, we've often discussed here on the program the idea, and it's taken flesh, so to speak, in many of our case studies, where work, or at least part-time work, was a part of the retirement solution. And not only is it a part of the retirement solution, there are studies showing that people who do keep involved in something that's really worthwhile after they retire, they live longer because they have purpose in their lives. So it's no surprise that work was mentioned as a part of a retirement solution. So give us a quick thumbnail sketch of the report that came out recently before we get into the details.
As I said here, in what this report is referring to, there's a major paradigm shift in the views and, let's say, the attitudes about retirement with boomers. And especially middle-income boomers view employment, John, as part of the retirement experience. According to the survey, and these are just some brief sketches of it, a summary, 28% of retired boomers are currently employed or employed in the past since they retired. Now, we ought to define here what I mean retired. Let's say your last job, you worked 20 years for a company, and either due to layoff or because of the retirement program, you retired from that company. So that's what we mean when we talk about retired, because some of the numbers that we're going to be talking about here won't seem to make sense. So you mainly retired from the main occupation that you were involved in through your working career. Now, another statistic, those not retired, 48% said, you know what, when I do retire, I want to work or do something. And of those retired working, 61% want to work, not because they have to, because they want to. And another 60% of employed retirees, the primary reason they work is non-financial, including, John, as you mentioned, staying mentally alert, physically active. And here's a surprising one. And this gets to a lot of the things we talk about in the program here about increasing longevity. Half or nearly 49% of middle income boomers plan on working beyond the age of 70. John, we didn't talk about stuff like this 20 and 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's a different world, different time, different day. And it's not necessarily bad, as you said. And what we do know, we know one thing, is that people are living longer. So it's not really surprising that work is some form of retirement. I mean, my mother was a regular volunteer at a local hospital for over 20 years. That's what she did in retirement to keep herself busy. Now, what kind of work is available? There are different jobs. There's more part-time available out there, flexible hours. Some people have their own businesses. You can do a lot of this now on the internet and keep yourself busy doing that. They're working, but is it really the same kind of work as we looked at, say, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago?
You know, it really is different. 88% of the boomers working have work arrangements other than, let's say, full-time work. It could be part-time work, which is about 58% of those that work. Freelance work, 18%. I know we have several clients who have retired from big corporations that have gone back as sort of consultants, but it's mainly part-time work. And you also have, for example, seasonal type work. You know, you have things like during the Christmas holidays, tax season. And so 7% is about seasonal. Now, 4 out of the 10 or 42% say they're self-employed. They've started some kind of business. And despite working, most boomers reported they're much happier. They're more satisfied with work than, let's say, when they were working their regular jobs during their working career. And more importantly, John, they're reporting lower levels of stress, so they're leading actually healthier and more productive lives. If there was a drawback, I guess if there's got nothing to be perfect, 72% reported that their per hour compensation is less in retirement, but money has not been a key motivator here. They enjoy the work that they do, and they enjoy being active.
Okay, well, what about those who are now working differently? I mean, there were different reasons why people actually do this. Was it because the possibilities retired too soon? They were laid off unexpectedly as a result of the great downturn that we saw back in the end of the first decade here? What about health reasons? So what led them to retire and then to suddenly decide, I want to start working again?
You know, nearly 69% said they retired earlier than expected, and 79% listed the reasons were not in their control. For example, personal health reasons. That was about 39% for why people retired earlier. Laid off was about 19%. Another 9% retired to take care of a loved one. Maybe they had a sick spouse. But over 2/3 of those working are doing so primarily because they want to work. And that was one of the key reports here and is a major, major paradigm shift when you think about retirement. If you look at the survey, 60% of pre-retirees in the survey say they plan on doing some kind of work in retirement. In fact, 68% say they do so because they really want to do some form of work. Key here is they want some form of flexibility. They want flex time, maybe telecommuting. So most are looking for some kind of flexible work hours or work arrangement with an employer. Not many want to get back into the grind, John, of the 40-hour work week, or in some cases with many executives, a 50 and 60-hour work week. They want to do something, but they just don't want to get back into that 40-hour grind. But, you know, some of them working 20 hours. I've seen in the survey, you know, the number of people that were working 20 hours and the number of people that were working 30, 10 to 15. And there was quite a broad range. Safe to say the bulk of them were less than 40 hours a week.
Well, exactly how does this break down if we look at the numbers between people who are just simply retired and aren't working at all, or at some time during their retirement, they actually did have a job or they were doing some work? This is a paradigm shift. So if we look at it with numbers, how pronounced a trend is it?
Well, I mean, according to the survey, among boomers considered retired, 20% are currently employed for pay or have been employed for pay at some point in their retirement since they left their main job. But of those retired, only about 11% are actually employed currently, with about 17% mentioning they had at one time work. So let's say you retired, you got into retirement, and you're sitting around and you go, you know, I'm sort of bored with what I'm doing right now. Maybe I'll go get a job. Maybe you go back. I've seen over and over again a number of our clients who have left, let's say, a large corporation who have gone back part-time as a consultant. Now, some of them have worked, for example, on a project. We see this a lot with some of our engineer-type clients where they'll be called in to work on a project part-time, and once the project's finished, then, you know, they go back into retirement. So roughly about 11% are currently working, with about 70, you add the other 17% who at some time during their retirement were actually doing some kind of work, and that gets you to that 28% figure.
Now, I imagine this trend will only increase in years ahead. We're seeing this as an onrushing trend, given if you look at how many people are actually prepared for retirement, a lot of people are going to have to continue working as part of it. Also, as policies of financial repression continuing robbing savers of returns.
Well, you know, the surprising aspect of the survey, it contrasts between those that are non-retired boomers and employed versus the retired boomers who are working. 71% of boomers still are working, and working because they have to. They're saying, hey, I wish I could retire, but I just can't. I don't have enough money saved up. My 401k, my assets aren't there. I may have a mortgage. I have debt. I'm taking care of a loved one. You know, and you compare that to versus, let's say, 61% say they are doing so working. These are retired boomers who are saying, look, I'm working because I really want to work. I don't want to just sit around and be idle. There's something that I want to do. So you have two kinds of classes of boomers. One that are saying, okay, I'm retired, but I want to go back and do something. And those that are sort of in that pre-retirement market, and they're saying, I wish I could retire, but there's just no way. I just don't have the money. We have debt. We just can't pay our bills, or our sources of income in retirement are just not there.
Now, is money not necessarily an issue then? I mean, are there other reasons for why they want to work?
More often, as is the case, roughly close to 60% of the time, they're working for non-financial reasons. You know, for example, to stay mentally alert. And we've seen studies over and over, including Dr. Gary Small from UCLA Center for Longevity, where he talked about dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, you're less likely to get that when you're active mentally and physically. That was another thing that mentioned, that they want to remain physically active. And also something more important, they want to maintain a sense of purpose. You mentioned, for example, your mother worked as a volunteer at a hospital for nearly two decades. And there's also the social communication that takes place when you're in the workforce around other people. So being socially connected was another one.
Now, we ought to talk about the broader implications of this. How difficult is it for retirees to find work? Because you hear about the ceiling that people who are closer to retirement are encountering. They say, well, I'm in my 50s. I can't get rehired because they're going to hire somebody younger than I am. So how hard is it for retirees to find work, especially work that fits flexible hours and schedules, which they might need?
You know, here's the thing that was surprising, because we've heard a lot since the financial crisis about work, the unemployment rate. According to the survey, 80% of those employed retirees found it somewhat easy to find a job versus only 56% of non-retirees. I wonder what that is. Probably one of them is they're only looking for part-time work. That's probably one reason. Two, is they're working for less money than what they were paid when they were working full time. Less than 10% really said it was difficult to find work. In most instances, those who did find jobs were working for, as I mentioned, less pay, which is one reason maybe why it's easier for them to find work. And, you know, once again, financial is not the motivation, because if, you know, your employer says, hey, we'd love to have you work 20 hours a week, we're looking for a part-time position, I think that's a major factor here why they're finding it easy to work, because employers are looking for people that they can have flex hours where they can let you go if they have to. For example, if it's seasonal work for like the Christmas season or tax season. The other amazing fact here was the transition between pre and post-retirement took 6 months or less. In fact, more than one third or 35% continued to work right after they retired. So maybe, you know, your employer is going to say to you, or you know, some early retirement package is coming. And you're saying, you know what, I'm not ready for it, but I'm not going to have much of a choice. And you start looking at something that you have in the back of your mind that you want to do. So that was something that was also amazing about this survey.
You know, maybe we should clarify some definitions here, because when people are retired, we say they're retired and working. Theoretically, if they're working, they're not retired. So how do you distinguish between those who are working, retired and doing some work, and just fully retired?
When they distinguish in this survey, when they say retired and working, what they meant is, let's just take it easy. Just say that you worked for the government for 30 years of your life, or you were in the military, or, you know, you worked for a defense contractor, you worked for a company, you know, for a considerable period of time, and you reached that point where you had enough money saved up, or you had a pension plan, Social Security, you got to that age, and you retired. So retiring from your full-time occupation is really probably the definition that they want to use here. Now, once you retire, and then you do something on the side, whether it's full-time, part-time, in most instances, it is flex time. Now, what I've seen, John, at least with some of my clients that have done it, I had a doctor who worked part-time instead of the 40-hour weeks and being on call. You know, he worked about a 20-hour work week, and he did that. He retired at age 66 from his practice, and he continued to work an additional 4 years until he was age 70 when he fully retired. I've had engineering clients, especially with some of the big defense contractors, who retired, or they had some kind of bonus package that was put together. They retired from the company, but they were either called back to work on a specific project. And when they went to work on that specific project, they might have been working 40-hour weeks. And then when the project was over, then they went back into a retirement situation. So we're seeing just about everything in this kind of category. So, you know, that's why I think it's very important when we talk about one of the reasons that this work is defined as a retiree who is working, a lot of it is with flex hours. And according to the survey, those that were looking for flexibility, 29% said, I work fewer hours. 27% said, I work because I want to, not because I have to. 14% said, hey, I set my own schedule. 9% saying, I'm working for less money. 6% said, I have a job with less responsibility. 5%, I'm not trying to climb the company ladder anymore. 5% said, I changed my career or job. And then about 5% others. So you can see that the real key thing here is they're not working that 40, 50-hour week. The other surprising aspect is about half of those working part-time see themselves working beyond the age of 70. Now, I have several clients who are in their 70s right now working and mentally alert, sharp as a tack, love what they're doing. But more importantly, John, they love that flexibility they have now that they didn't have during their working career. So if they want to take off 2 or 3 weeks, go on an extended vacation for 2 or 3 weeks, they don't have to worry about, got to get back and get right into work again, especially when you're traveling overseas. As you get older, the adjustment, the jet lag, the different time zones, and that's what they're doing.
You know, that fits in with the idea of an extension of longevity. Retirees are living longer, but having purpose helps you to live longer. Somehow your body seems to be attuned to that. That either fits into Maslow's hierarchy of needs or Viktor Frankl's concept of man's search for meaning. It's basically self-fulfillment and what every human being really needs, and that's purpose.
Yeah, and that's another interesting thing about this survey. When you talk about, you know, the number of reasons for work, a lot of it was basically fulfillment. And it's interesting to see the hierarchy of this between, let's say, non-retired boomers, those are boomers still working, and employed retired boomers, those that have retired from their full-time job. Number one, fulfillment, both for non-retired boomers and retired boomers. Number one was family. Number two, between the two, was friends. Now, here's where it changes a little bit. Third, among non-retired boomers, was spirituality. Among retired boomers, it was hobbies, for obvious reasons. If you're not working as many hours, you have more free time to spend on hobbies. Number four was work for non-retired boomers. Number four was travel for retired boomers. Five was hobbies for non-retired boomers. It was spirituality for retired boomers. That one surprised me. Number six was romantic for non-retired boomers. Maybe that reflects a lot of the aging demographics, second families, the divorce rates. It was work was number six for retired boomers. Travel was number seven for non-retired boomers. And volunteering, like your mother, John, was number seven for employed retired boomers.
Now, here's an interesting question. What impact is all of this having on the economy? I mean, we know from labor statistics that the participation rate is down. That reflects a large part of number of boomers who are entering into retirement. So I'd be curious about that one.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is affecting the workforce today because, you know, those boomers that are going to work, as I mentioned, 80% of the survey said they had no trouble finding a job. And I think that has a lot to do with this economy being as anemic as it is. I think a lot of employers are saying, you know what? I don't mind somebody looking for flexible hours and part-time. I may not have to pay as much. I don't have to provide benefits. It's more cost efficient for employers. But, you know, those jobs obviously are going to retirees, and obviously that makes less jobs available for those who are, you know, coming into the workforce, let's say coming out of college. So for employers, it's a major plus. For one, retirees bring more experience to the job. They generally have more people skills, and that comes with experience, not to mention the technical skills that comes from experience. And plus, and this is something that employers are looking for, they basically are paid less money.
Well, it's obvious that the baby boom trend to continue working is going to only grow as time goes forward. They're tending to do that not for financial reasons, this is interesting, but rather motives of self-fulfillment. And you can see that this is going to be one of the big issues there, is to just as have purpose in life. And with 0% interest rates continuing for some time, or at least things that are going to be very low, depending on how fast the Fed ever raises the rates, this is going to be an important factor and an important part of retirement planning. Now that we've said all of this, let's do a case study where we actually see this play out. As with all of our case studies, the scenarios are actually real. They're based on real life scenarios. We've just simply changed the names to protect the privacy of the individuals involved.
The case this week is Carl and Tish Springer. Carl was 64, Tish was 61. In this case, Carl got an early retirement package that was sort of unexpected. It was a couple of years after the financial crisis. The company was downsizing, trying to cut their workforce. And they said, hey, if you retire early, we're going to give you a package. He basically got 1 year's salary as an incentive. And then, of course, he had access to his 401k program. The thing was, Carl got a salary of $84,000, roughly about a year's pay. His wife, Tish, working in medical, she had income roughly about $31,000 a year. So their total income when they were working was $115,000. The problem is Carl had type 2 diabetes. Their basic budget, John, was roughly about $7,000 a month. That added up to roughly $74,000 a year. Things they like to do, which was mainly travel, about $10,500. That was rounded off and say their budget was about $95,000.
Okay, well, now given the fact that they're retired and they're not old enough, when they started into this for Social Security, what did they have? Pension packages or something like that?
No, not really. I mean, you know, they had assets. They had a home of $700,000 with a $300,000 mortgage in Escondido, investments, including IRAs, 401ks, and CDs. They had about $740,000. Now, when Carl turned 66, which it was 2 years away when we began his plan, his Social Security would be roughly about $1,800 a month, and that would be $21,600. Tish's would be roughly $900 a month if she took it at age 62, which would be in 1 year, and $1,200 a year if she waited till age 66. So that would be roughly about $10,800 at age 62, so a little over $32,000 a year. Well, we had an $84,000 monthly expense. And so we looked at some options and we discussed them. Number one, Tish could postpone retirement. That was an option. Along that, too, with Tish continuing to work, Carl would be able to, let's say, find some part-time work as a means of supplementing that income, because we had a shortfall here of just slightly under $50,000. A second option was sell the home and downsize, pay cash for a place, take the proceeds, buy a less costly home, and take some of the equity they had in their house and put that into the investment portfolio or some kind of combination of the above. And so this was sort of what we threw out there. But, you know, there were many concerns that they had about which way they would go.
Yeah. And what were their major concerns?
You know, just like everybody else today, with people living longer, outliving their income or their assets, higher inflation. Carl was well aware of the cost, especially with diabetes, of medical. Investment returns were less than expected, especially after what happened in the financial crisis, and especially medical costs in the case of Carl's diabetes.
Okay, those are all the facts, the scenario. How did the outcome proceed?
Well, the idea of Tish continuing to work, especially with her husband's health and then Carl going back to work, that just wasn't an option. And so basically, they were already thinking in the back of their mind of selling the house and downsizing. They had friends that lived in a retirement community here in North County here in San Diego. You have a lot of mobile homes, a lot of manufactured homes built around the golf course, retirement community, and they had been looking at that and thinking of it. And I said, well, you know, something's got to give here. We either got to work or we have to do something. And so the option was to sell the house. And there were a number of reasons for doing that. Selling the house would get rid of the mortgage payments. It would get rid of the property taxes. And that's indeed what they did. They sold the house for roughly close to $700,000. They bought a manufactured home for $180,000, much smaller, but it was right there in a retirement community on a golf course. That did a couple things. Number one, it got rid of almost $1,500 a month in mortgage payments. It got rid of almost $6,000 in property taxes. So that alone, John, was $2,000 a month in savings. And so that $2,000 a month in savings reduced that outgo from $7,000 a month to $5,000 a month. We're getting now down to close to $60,000 a year. The other thing it did is it freed up additional assets. They walked out of their home with basically about $400,000 in equity. They put $180,000 down, paying cash for the manufactured home, leaving them with a couple $100,000. We added that to the investment base, and the result was we got an additional $8,000 a year in income. So the end result was income went up by $8,000 a year, expenses went down by $24,000 a year, the net difference of $32,000. So now they were able to live. Their house was free and clear. No longer did they have mortgage payments. They had a larger investment portfolio to draw on. And then on top of that, you know, they didn't have to work. And then the thing that really gets nice is at age 62, the decision was made because they could use the extra $900. That would really make a major difference. Tish was going to go for her Social Security. And then the next thing that we decided is that Carl, being age 64, only had 2 years to go for his Social Security, which would be an additional $21,600. So really, in 2 years, they were really going to be looking pretty good. And we decided that at age 66, what would happen? Carl would file for his benefits. He would get full benefits. That's the 21-6. Tish would file for half of Carl's and allow hers to accumulate to age 70 because hers wasn't very much. It would have been $1,200 at age 62. It would be closer to $2,000 a month at age 70. So we had really two big inflation hedges. We had Carl's Social Security coming in 2 years at age 66, which would be 21-6. And then in about another 8 years for Tish, we would have almost $2,000 a month kicking in when Tish could basically get rid of the part that she was taking of Carl's one half and take her own Social Security, allowing it to accumulate. So by downsizing, getting rid of mortgage payments, free and clear home, freeing up some capital, and also with some strategy involving Social Security, basically was how we solved the issues here.
And as always, another success story is coming up next here on Lifetime Income. Our guest is Veronica Dagger of the Wall Street Journal, Reasons for Parents to Reveal Their Estate Plans, as the Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Dealing with estate issues is a very difficult issue in life. After all, nobody wants to think about eventually what happens in the end. But discussing issues with children can also be difficult. There's sibling rivalry. There could be different situations for each child. Joining me on the program is Veronica Dagger. She writes for the Wall Street Journal on financial and wealth management. And Veronica, let's begin with the idea of speaking to kids about what's in their estate plan. I mean, quite honestly, as you wrote in your article, that's about as appealing as, let's say, talking about sex.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Not a lot of parents want to talk to their kids about this. In this article, as you know, it's really focused on talking to your adult kids about this. And even when your kids are adults, you know, you're in your 70s or 80s and your kids are in their 40s or 50s, the parents just aren't really keen to do this. It's a really sensitive topic, and I think it's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is, well, you're talking about it, you as the parent, you're thinking about your own mortality, and nobody really wants to do that. And then there's also concerns, you know, how do you bring this up with your kids? Is there going to be sense from your kids if they know how much they're going to get once you die? Are they going to get unmotivated? Are they going to become entitled? Are they only going to like you for your money? There's a lot of issues. And then kids being people in their 40s and 50s, or, you know, people old enough to inherit, certainly could be younger than that, might not want to bring it up either because it is sort of awkward because, you know, like, how do I say this without sounding tacky or like a, you know, gold digger, so to speak? So in general, families are avoiding it. More and more families are talking about it, but the majority of folks, and also the wealthier they are, the more they tend to avoid it. It's just not an appealing topic for a lot of folks.
And what about also, too, the issue where you may run into a family where, let's say, there's four or five siblings. One sibling is having a tougher time economically. They're mm-hmm. struggling. It could be a divorced parent. Mm-hmm. It could be maybe someone that got laid off. But obviously, you know, there's a major difference financially between the kids. And there's a tendency, at least I've seen this, Veronica, and you write about it, for a parent to say, well, you know, I want to help out my daughter. She's having a tougher time. So instead of giving her 1/4 the estate, I'm going to give her 1/3 of the estate. And then that parent passes away. And then what happens is, you know, the other children find out when the will is read and there's resentment.
That's exactly right. That's a great question. Yeah, resentment, in short, is definitely going to ensue in that case if there's no communication. Even if one sibling isn't having financial trouble, say they're all doing okay, and one of them just happens to have three kids, and one sibling only has one kid or no kids, and they find out the grandparents left more money to the family that has more children, that's also going to cause resentment. So there's all different situations where this could arise. It's a really sensitive issue. And for that very reason that you mentioned, it's really important to sit down with the children. And how you do this is up to you. Some people do it individually with each heir. You sit them down and talk them through what's going to happen and why you made the decisions. But they really recommend doing this before you die, because if you do it after you die, chances are the heirs are going to find out about all this at the reading of your will, you know, in a lawyer's office, for example. And that could be a really tough time. It might leave them feeling like, oh, why did they do this? Did they love my sibling, you know, more than me? Did they value them more than me? They might also question some decisions like, oh, how come one sibling was left to be the executor of the will, left to be in charge of making financial decisions, and another sibling wasn't? And that also might cause resentment if they're put in a fiduciary role and their sibling isn't put in that role. And so I think it's important for parents to sit down and talk to their kids about this and say, like, you know, why are we making these unequal distributions if that's the case? Why did you put something in a trust if that's the case? Explain your motivation so once you die, you're not leaving them some family issues going forward. If you have a good family dynamic, why mess it up now? Why cause resentments now once you leave? You don't want that to be your inheritance to your family, a really a chaotic family life. Once you're gone, that's not a good inheritance to leave.
And you know, the other thing that I see too is, like, let's say parents have a trust and all of a sudden they'll name, let's say mom and dad live in Sun City, Arizona, and junior or a daughter lives in, I don't know, Newark, New Jersey. And all of a sudden they name that child as the successor trustee, not realizing all the responsibilities that have to be done settling a trust, or even worse, if there isn't a trust. And they name family members to come in and handle something that, as you know, Veronica, can be quite complex.
That's right. You know, you got to think about geography and all of this, whether it's making them trustees or having them to make financial decisions. You want to check with them first to see if this would even be convenient or they're even equipped to do this. Like you said, a family member, some of your family members may not be good with the financial end of things. So you might want to leave it to a professional, like a financial advisor. It really depends on your situation. Also, somebody just might be too busy and too overwhelmed with their own life to make these sort of, take this sort of leadership role. So I think you might be surprised if, you know, you sit down and you talk to your kids and find out maybe who's interested. Maybe one of them is in the financial field and is better equipped to make these decisions and take on that leadership role. Maybe someone stays at home and maybe has a little bit more time on their hands than someone else who's working full time. Maybe they could take more of a role. But also, you know, like you said, considering geography is a big deal, because if someone's clear across the country in a different time zone, it might make their life a lot more difficult.
Well, you wrote an article recently called Five Reasons for Parents to Reveal Estate Plans. Let's talk about the first one. You have a chance to smooth some ruffled feathers. Let's talk about the advantages of doing that.
Right. So while you're still alive, you can inform your heirs about, like, what's going to be in your will. And so by doing that in advance, you can avoid some of these sibling rivalries amongst your heirs that might happen if they're just finding out after you're dead. So you can explain to them, why did your son who's got the three kids get more money than me who only has one kid? You can explain those sort of decisions to them in advance. You can also explain your charitable decisions, too. Sometimes we've seen heirs getting really resentful of their parents' bequest to charities and other non-family beneficiaries. It's like, why do you leave so much to charity? You know, my family could have used the money. Well, this is your chance to explain your decision. Obviously, you're not asking for permission from your heirs. You're explaining. You may be open to suggestions from them in terms of how you might want to adapt your plan. But at the same time, you're getting things out in the open before you're in a sort of a crisis mode or your family is finding out after you die. That way you can alleviate hurt feelings. You can put your decisions in your own words by explaining to them face to face instead of them reading something in a document and them being left to interpret what you meant and what you were feeling and your thought process. I think sitting them down and giving it a more personal feel than just a piece of paper can really help. Now, if you're not equipped to do that yourself, you can always bring in your financial advisor to help, or your estate lawyer to be that mediator, to be that translator, or sort of a neutral presence if you're worried about how your kid's going to react. But in general, all the experts say communication is better than no communication. The mistake you can make is not saying anything. Now, obviously, there's some exceptions to this. You know, if one of your heirs has an addiction, serious issues like that, this may be a different set of circumstances, but in general, what we're talking about is people who are healthy and functioning heirs, capable of making decisions, capable of being financially independent. In those cases, open communication is the best bet.
You suggest sometimes it may be done better, let's say a family group meeting where you're saying, hey, this is our estate, this is what we're going to do. I suppose that would be easier if you had four kids and you say each one of you is going to get 25% versus we're going to give a third to your younger sister and then we're going to give 25% to our favorite charity. Sometimes you say this is really depending on family dynamics, whether you do it with each child individually or you do it as a group. Let's talk about the difference between the two. I suspect if you have a lot of family dynamics going on, it might be better to do that one-on-one individually.
That's right. Like you said, you really need to judge your own family dynamics. There's people who are family dynamics coaches for the very wealthy, but as a function in some of these wealth management firms, you can enlist the help of these folks to help you assess. There's coaches you can work with ahead of time to help you learn how to phrase the conversation, how you're going to deliver the message. So maybe it's a therapist or someone who can talk you through how to communicate this message and who can help you assess, you know, what's the family dynamic? Is it best for us to do this in a group? And within that group, is it just the immediate heirs, or is it the heirs and their spouses? Or is it the heirs, the spouses, and the grandkids? Help you understand what's best for your family. And you probably have a sense of that. You probably have a sense of the spirit of your family and how the siblings get along. So that's going to factor into your decision, whether you want to do this in a group or one-on-one with each heir individually. That might be a better option for some families.
Let's talk about the second one, which is save them hassles and prevent mistakes. And boy, I have seen this and what a problem it creates. And especially when you don't have all your assets categorized, you know where they are, or at least somebody, whether it's your attorney, trustee, knows where the assets are. I can remember back when I was first starting my career in the 80s of a client, they were in a concentration camp, World War II. So when they came to this country, they had assets all over. And you probably have heard the story about W.C. Fields, who used to have bank accounts all over the country. And in this particular case, Veronica, it was literally several years after the husband passed away, we were still finding assets that existed. So you talk about one of the reasons you would might want to do this, at least somebody knows where the assets are, what they are, or whether it's going to be a successor trustee, your lawyer, a financial advisor, or let's say one member of the family, but also it sometimes can save some hassles and prevent some major mistakes.
That's right. That's such a good point, because the last thing you want to do to your heirs when they're grieving is to throw them into financial chaos as they're looking to clean up your estate, look for all these assets, hunt down different accounts, hunt down, you know, the cemetery deed, hunt down your will, find out who your financial advisor is. They don't need to be doing this when they're grieving, and I doubt you want to do that to them either. That's a real drag. And like you said, this could go on for years. We've heard stories, and like you said, you've worked with people. This can take a really long time to track down different accounts, especially if you don't have things like passwords, or especially if you didn't even know if some of these accounts exist. So you can save them a lot of time and a lot of hassle and a lot of headaches by informing them ahead of time of what you own, where it is, what those passwords to those accounts are, if you're ready to do that and share that, how they can, you know, what your wishes for those accounts are. I think that those are also important, what your plans are, and not make them scramble. I know some people say, you know, just keep either a digital file or actually a physical file, like a file box of all your recent statements in Excel, put a list together of your accounts, where they're at, who the contact is. That way your heirs have a quick go-to sheet. They're not left scrambling. They know what they're in for, and they're not going to get a statement 2 years from now and be like, wait, what is this? And how do we deal with it? You know, it's probably not that hard for you to do, just to come up with maybe one sheet of where everything is, just to consolidate that in one place would be really helpful for them. Also, speaking of consolidation, it might make sense for you to start consolidating some of your accounts. I mean, I think the longer folks live, the tendency is to have accounts all over the place, you know, especially if you're married and you have your accounts and your husband has your accounts, what have you. You know, if, as you age, or even at any age, you might want to start narrowing the amount of accounts you have. That way, it's less hassle for you and it's less hassle for your heirs as well.
Let's talk about something else that can be sometimes a touchy topic, and I've seen this, I deal with this quite often. Increasing the quality of life for your children. Let's say you're fortunate enough, you have lots of income, you've accumulated, let's say, some substantial amount of assets, but you have some children that are, let's say, struggling, or you talk about a case where a family member started a business. It was a struggle at first, and eventually it took off. But sometimes parents can go a long way in relieving the stress and anxiety for their children during difficult times and lessen some of the burden rather than, let's say, wait till they pass on.
That's right. There's more of a trend of this sort of giving while living. More wealthy folks are doing that with charities and also doing with their heirs in certain cases. Especially if you've got a child who's struggling, you want to make a difference in their life. Maybe they're struggling because they're going through a divorce or some other issue. Or maybe they're just trying to start up their business and really need that extra investment to get the business going. Whatever the case, you could make a difference in their life now instead of waiting till later. I spoke to some folks who found out after years and years of struggling in their business, they found out they were inheriting, you know, $1 million or so from their parents. And they were happy, but they also had some resentment, too, because they said, you know, I could have used this in the years that I could barely make my rent as I was building my business. You know, like, I wasn't entitled. I was working hard. I was showing a good effort. And I understand that you were trying to do this whole tough love thing, but there is a fine line. And you need to really think about, as a parent, how you can give that practical assistance to an heir who needs it and who's going to use it responsibly. Whether, you know, you're giving that money outright or whether you're deciding to give that money as a loan, it's your decision. But there is an opportunity for that, you know, and you can meet with your heir and see, you know, are they at a place where they could use your help and really understand their stress and anxiety if they're having financial issues. I think there's also something to be said about seeing the benefits of your wealth helping someone within your lifetime. I think more and more people are excited by that, are looking for that. And if you can have that sort of impact within your own family, that can be pretty powerful than when you're dead, when you'll never see the impact.
And don't you think also, Veronica, it's a chance sometimes, and I have a client that is doing this right now, very, very wealthy client, they are making a bequest to each one of their three children, and they're giving them a substantial sum in today's money. They want to see how they handle it. It's kind of like, okay, let's see how savvy they are, what they do with it. And based on how they see that transpire, may ultimately change their estate plan down the road, whether they're going to leave just the income from the assets at their death or the assets themselves get distributed. But they're sort of testing the waters to see how well the children handle it.
I think that's a great idea. Test it out, see how they handle it, see if they're ready for it. Also, give them the chance to learn. Maybe some of them, maybe they would be good with money, they just haven't had the experience of handling it. So by testing out early on, you can help them build the skills to handle more money when they're ready to inherit it. So I think that's a real service to people. I think that's another real benefit of telling people ahead of time how much they may be inheriting. It gives them a chance to think through and learn the skills and adapt their finances, adapt their lifestyle to this money, and also give them a chance to practice in a smaller way before they get that larger sum of money. So I think that's a great idea. There's also the question of things like real estate. If you tell them, say, Susie, you're getting the beach house, Johnny, you're getting the mainland house, and so-and-so's getting the house in France, I think if you can talk through those sort of things before you die, you may find out that, you know, Susie wants the house in France but doesn't want the beach house or whatever you have arranged, and give them a chance to negotiate perhaps for the asset they truly want and what would be better for them and their lifestyle. You could find out that your heirs don't want any of your real estate. Maybe they just would rather you sell it and get the inheritance that way because they're traveling a lot for their jobs and don't have time to use the vacation house, for example. So running your plans by them may help you adjust your plans and help you get a sense of what is really important to them and what's practical for them as well. And that's another way to avoid fights once you're gone as well.
You know, let's talk about your fourth factor here, too, because this may relate to what we just previously discussed. The children might give you a better idea. So, you know, let's say parents have this perception of, okay, this is what we want to do. We think this is going to be best. sometimes, and especially when there's a certain amount of assets, there's difference between siblings. You know, one sibling has four kids, the other one only has two, or one doesn't have any. Getting some input from the kids.
Yes, I think that's really important, especially, you know, when it's a home or a business that's involved, advanced communication is really important. You know, talk through who's going to get the lake house, you know, and why. One client we spoke to, he put a stipulation in his estate plan that if the family's vacation house wasn't used by the heirs at least 125 days a year, the trustee would be required to sell it. Well, once he spoke to his heirs about this, they said, look, we have an illness in the family. We travel a lot. We're not going to be able to guarantee this 125-day-a-year usage requirement. And the father thought more about it after talking to his kids and said, you know what, I understand your point. I'm not going to eliminate the usage requirement, but I'm going to reduce it to a more reasonable level. And to his credit, he listened to his heirs, he got their feedback, and now the family is happy with the arrangement, and it's something more doable for them. But he wouldn't have found that out unless he had run that by them ahead of time. Similarly, you know, if you said if you have, you know, a house and maybe one sibling wants it, the other one perhaps doesn't want anything to do with it. The same thing with a business. But you'll never know those things unless you talk to them ahead of time. And I think that's really important, that communication piece.
Let's talk about maybe the fifth reason to do this, and that may involve gifting, it may involve a charitable trust, it may involve different trust, a limited liability corporation, but also saving taxes, because, you know, a husband and wife, one of the best things they could do to save taxes would be to get a living trust that allows a double exemption on the death of each spouse. You save $10.6 million there. But if you're beyond that, let's say you have higher assets than that, then you can talk about, you know, maybe transferring income to grandchildren for education. There's all kinds of things that you could do with tax planning today, and people just don't take advantage of it unless you get into these discussions.
That's right, especially in cases where the children already are wealthy enough that they'll owe taxes on their own assets. Without the assets, the parents are going to leave them. It's important to have these conversations with them because they might say, hey, don't leave us anymore. You know, like you said, give it to the grandkids, use a generation skipping trust, or do something to help the next generation, not us, because of our taxes. So that's another reason to coordinate your estate plans with your adult children, because maybe you're not fully aware of their prosperous financial situation. Maybe you think they're doing well, but you didn't realize they were doing that well. So it's important to talk that over with them and perhaps pass more wealth directly to the grandkids, or pass more of their assets while they're still alive, give more to charity. You don't know how your financial plan is really going to change until you have these conversations. And so that is definitely worth doing, as taxes certainly play a part in all of this.
You cite a statistic which I thought amazing, and this is on bequests. Most people have a current will, but many of them don't discuss the contents with their heirs. So 83%, according to the survey, have an up-to-date will. 54% have discussed plans with children, and 34% let heirs know amount of wealth. What do you think accounts for most of this?
I think it's that reluctance to talk. People know that they need to have an up-to-date will, but there's still a high percentage that don't want to talk about it because, like I said, they're afraid to talk about it because it reminds them of their death. Maybe the heirs themselves also say, Mom, Dad, I don't want to hear you talk about it. I don't want to picture a time when you're not here, because it's a bit of a morbid thought. So that could be part of it. Also, that whole entitlement question that we spoke about before, some people are reluctant because they don't want their kids to lose that work ethic. They want their kids to keep out there in the workforce and not rely on money that they didn't make themselves. And so they want to keep that motivation up. And so that could get them talking. Some people just don't think it's a pressing issue, you know? You never really feel like, oh, I'm not going to die. You know, like, I mean, how often do people really think about that? And so, well, I'll talk to them in 5 years when I'm a little bit older. And, you know, 5 years comes along and they're like, oh, maybe another 5 years from now. And so that could be part of it as well. And also, some people just don't want their kids counting on the inheritance, because let's face it, people are living longer and longer, and you might think you're going to be able to give your kids X amount of dollars when you're dead, but you might live longer than you expected, and you might need that money to pay for your own health care. And so that inheritance that they're banking on may not be there. And so that's also part of some people's hesitation. They're afraid to show all their cards because they could be uncertain about their own financial future. So that factors in as well.
You know, this is something that you just brought up that we see, and especially with medical care, because a lot of people think when they retire, they spend most of their time in the early years of retirement because that's when you're healthy, you're doing a lot of travel. Many people don't realize that the older they get, that their expenses may be going up, and it may be for medical issues. One spouse gets Alzheimer's, so now they have to go in a special care facility. You're supporting, let's say, two households. Or there's medical expenses. You're in and out of hospital. There's prescription drugs. A lot of this stuff comes up, and I've also seen, Veronica, mistakes made where, you know, one time, and this was back in the days before the exemption was $5.3 million, a lot of money was being given away. And of course, Veronica, remember 2010 when there was no estate taxes? If you died in 2010, George Steinbrenner timed it perfectly. But there was this feeling that we were going to go back to the million-dollar exemption. And I saw a lot of cases where substantial assets were given away in 2010 because everybody thought the estate taxes were going to go up back to where they used to be, and the exemption was going to drop to millions. So you're right. You don't know how long you're going to live. You don't know how much of those assets will be needed to take care of you medically during your latter part of your life.
That's right. You never know what the future is going to hold and your financial situation. That's why you also always need to look at your investments, make sure you're invested properly and that your risk tolerance really matches up with what you can tolerate, because you never know what's going to happen in the market. So you want to watch your exposure to stocks potentially, depending on where you are, and also bonds too. I mean, nothing is risk-free. And so you need to be looking at all of those things. And so, you know, one of the things you might say to your heirs is like, this is what we're planning to do, but things could change. So this is not by any means set in stone. We could change our minds just because we feel like it, or because we have to, because we need the money ourselves, or because, you know, the market tanks, whatever, we get sick, situations change, you never know. So don't bank on this, but this is our plan. That way you're caveating it, but at the same time, you're giving your heirs a chance to prepare mentally and also potentially alter their own financial plans if needs be. So you're not totally taking them by surprise, but you're giving them a little bit of a chance to prepare and adapt the idea of having more money if that's going to be the case. But again, like you said, you can always change it, and it's important to let heirs know that it's not set in stone. Things can really change radically within the course of a year if there is some sort of sickness.
Veronica, you know, when you take a look at the issues that we just discussed, whether it's speaking to your children one-on-one, getting the advice or the children's input, helping them when they need it, when they're younger, or, you know, maybe doing some tax planning, depending on the size of your estate, and who knows, they may change the laws again, which Congress is apt to do. If you were to take a look at this, would you advise maybe a couple, if they're not sure which route to go, maybe talk to an advisor, talk to an attorney, because sometimes it can be difficult, and there are a lot of issues that we have just raised here that a lot of parents aren't really thinking of when they're putting together their estate plan.
I think that's a great idea. Bring in someone else who's an expert in these issues, especially if, you know, there's a husband and wife there, you know, or two spouses. I think it's important to have someone else in the discussion, because there is a possibility the husband and wife aren't on the same page in terms of like what to leave to the kids. And so having a third party, like an attorney or an advisor, to get in the middle of that and think things through in another way, in an impartial way, I think is really helpful for some couples. I think that would be good. And also, maybe if you're single too, you know, you need another person to bounce ideas off of and help you plan. It may seem overwhelming to do all this planning on your own if you're a widow or widower. So I think that's an important concept. Bring someone else into this discussion who can help you, especially if you have tax issues that you need to consider. You really want to bring a professional in those situations especially.
Well, listen, Veronica, I really love the article you wrote, because there was a lot of good practical advice. If our listeners would like to follow your work, you write for the Wall Street Journal, and you also write for Fox. So how could they follow you if they would like to?
That'd be great. Thank you. And it's been great being on the program. My Twitter handle is at Veronica Dagger, and you can look at my articles on WSJ.com. Just search my name, and you can see videos on there as well.
Veronica, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. All the best to you, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
We'd love that. Thanks so much, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Hope you enjoyed that. I wanted to cover this issue because we run into so many problems that we see with parents, whether it's sibling rivalry, whether it is maybe taking the kids into consideration in terms of formulating your estate plan, or sometimes naming a child as a successor trustee, not realizing the distance issues, the financial savvy and education needed to settle estate could be a mistake. Once again, if you are thinking about your estate plan, you might want to talk to an advisor, whether it's your attorney, a financial advisor, get their input. But sometimes discussing these issues and really thinking through can make all the difference after you've passed on. Well, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.